I'm Marty Moscoen, and this is Radio Times in Review, our weekly show when we go back into our archives and highlight some of the best conversations from Radio Times past. Coming up, we'll hear three stories about perseverance. We'll talk about Italian physicist Enrico Fermi, a key architect of the atomic age. He had to flee fascist Italy in order to continue his research, which would eventually reshape the world. We'll also hear my discussion with New York Times writer Phyllis Korke. Her book, The Big Thing, discusses the challenges of overcoming procrastination, her own. But first, we'll hear my conversation with percussionist Patty Nimi and Christopher Davini. Nimi wrote about how practice and patience led to her becoming a percussionist with the San Francisco Opera Orchestra in her book, Sticking It Out. That's all coming up when Radio Times in Review continues after the news from NPR. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us today. You're hearing percussionist Patty Nimi's solo xylophone part of a song called Whirlwind, and you can hear the amount of practice that it took to achieve that level of precision. She's a percussionist with the San Francisco Opera Orchestra after attending the prestigious Juilliard School. She joined us to talk about how she persevered to prove herself, the subject of her book, Sticking It Out. She was accompanied by her partner, Christopher Davini, principal percussionist with the Philadelphia Orchestra. He can attest to the need to be patient, to practice, and persevere. Let's take a listen.
Was it unusual? What is this, the 70s, Patty, for a girl to be playing drums?
It was. I was the only one for a long time, right at the beginning. By the time I was in youth orchestra, it was not so unusual. My teacher in Rochester, New York, growing up, was a woman, which was wonderful. I had this role model that it never occurred to me that this was something I could not do. But it was unusual for a while.
Did people say, well, girls don't play drums kind of thing?
I got that comment occasionally, but no one I took seriously.
There you go.
However, though, I should say, we first only became aware of each other when we were both in the finals of the Boston Symphony Orchestra audition. We both lost. and that was my first experience of running into a female percussionist that was on such a high level. So
That was 1990.
That is, or back then at least, was an unusual occurrence.
You know, I mentioned the fact that I go to the orchestra and I watch you, Chris, and other members of the percussion. I have a really good view of what the percussionists are doing. Clearly, multi-instrumentalists. There's a lot of watching and waiting and listening. I find it fascinating watching certain members of the percussion part of the orchestra, just waiting for that moment when they're going to hit the triangle, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of our life. Yes,
it's what we do best, waiting.
Waiting and watching. Yeah. And so what are you doing while you're waiting and watching?
Oh, well, you can go.
I think hope just to pay attention, just keep paying attention. You get used to it. You get good at what you do. And we do wait a lot. So there's a lot of waiting, and waiting tends to exacerbate anxiety sometimes if you're thinking about what's hard to come up. You're
right.
Trying not to think about how hard it is, but you just get really good at concentrating through that period of time, listening to the music, enjoying what's going on.
You do, as I mentioned, Patty, you do write a lot about the kind of anxiety that you've had to deal with as a professional musician. Do you think it's unusual? Is there something unique about your kind of anxiety about performance, or even about thinking about performance?
I don't think so. I think a lot of people, musicians and non-musicians, have dealt with anxiety. Maybe it's just that I wrote a lot about it. But it's one of the things that, if people read the book, talk to me the most about.
Do they?
Is their issues with anxiety. So it's nice to know I'm certainly not alone. But at the time, and I wrote about this, at the time I went to Juilliard, it was something we didn't talk about. And I think it was embarrassment. I was certainly embarrassed how badly it affected me.
I mean, are we talking performance anxiety, the idea of anticipating something that could happen in a performance?
Yes, exactly. You start to think
about
it.
Like your mind gets ahead of yourself?
Yes. And thinking about those things is the worst thing you can do. Right. You don't want to imagine catastrophes, but I was great at doing that, imagining the catastrophes. So not thinking about it is thinking about it.
Of course, exactly. for a while. I don't know if you still do. And I don't even – I've heard of musicians taking things like Inderol,
yes.
I mean, ways of dealing with some of the anxiety. How did that help you?
It's miraculous at first because it takes away the thought that your hands are going to shake. So it takes that out of the equation. So initially, it helps quite a bit because that's all I was worried about. Are my hands going to shake? Well, no, they're not anymore.
Right.
But after a while, you start to think about other catastrophes. Am I going to have a memory slip? Am I, you know, just going to fall down on the job at this part? Am I not going to come in the right place? So unfortunately, you start to think about other things that
yeah.
can happen.
So do you still take Inderol?
Yes, I do when I need to.
When you know you've got a big performance or, I don't know, do you still audition for things?
No. And that was...
she says with a great deal of relief.
Yes. Auditions are well behind me, but that's the time I took it the most because auditions are really, really tough. But yeah, if there's a big performance, I will still take it.
Yeah. Is that unusual, do you think, Chris, among musicians?
To take Inderol?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so at all. It is somewhat stigmatic, and some people don't want to talk about that. I talk about it with my students that I teach. Some are looking for solutions to shaking, physical manifestations of their anxiety that only occur at an audition, wouldn't occur in a practice room, wouldn't occur with the performance of a regular ensemble. However, when you're on stage by yourself, even the audition process itself is really pretty quite different than the actual job.
It's brutal. Brutal. Yeah.
Because you're obviously competing for, one or two spots potentially, or maybe even one spot, just the high level of competition.
Yeah, and the rarity of auditions coming up. It can be one, two auditions a year, and that's a good year.
Yeah.
And one person will get the job, and there are probably about 75 other competitors there.
At least, yeah. And you know, as you know from coming to the orchestra, there's a large group of people on stage most of the time, upwards of 90 to 100 people. And all of a sudden, that same repertoire is put under a gigantic microscope, and it's just you.
Yeah.
That, all alone.
That dynamic is radically different than anything you even prepared for. So it's not uncommon that you would have these side effects from that experience at the audition.
But is it the physical shaking, or is it the kind of mental gymnastics or catastrophizing that you describe, Patty?
For me, it was everything. But Inderol is the best thing to help with the physical shaking. You know, your heart won't jump out of your skin and your hands won't shake so hard that you can't play.
Do you ever do meditation or things like that?
I've done a lot of things, yes.
Have you? Sort of quiet your mind?
Yes. For me, none of that helped enough. But still working, still trying.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess because musicians, it's a high wire act in many ways. But,
yes.
I mean, anxiety is, I think most people can relate to what we're talking about to some degree or another. You also talk, Patty, about perfectionism.
Yes.
I mean, obviously, as a high-level musician, that is the goal. Is it
yes.
attainable?
It's not attainable. You can get as close as you can. But perfectionism, I think, is another reason we get so anxious. We spend a lot of our practice time criticizing ourselves. You have to. You're in the practice room hours a day by yourself, and your job is to get better. The only way to do that is to point out your own flaws. And you can constructively criticize yourself. But all those hours doing that and then walk out the practice room door, stand on stage, and have the confidence to feel great about what you're doing. When you've previously spent all those hours
beating
yourself.
Well, let me quote something you hear. Despite the angst it produced, having perfection as a goal was liberating. There was no ambiguity involved in this pursuit. This idea that perfection was attainable started to dribble into the few areas of my life that did not involve music. And you talk about perfection and control.
Yes. Yeah, I think they go together quite well.
How so?
If you feel that perfection is your goal, and in music, sometimes it feels like you can attain that goal. The only way to do that is to control every aspect of your practice life, of your preparation for auditions. And control is, I think they go hand in hand. They certainly did for me.
Will you describe even being a bit of a neat freak? Is that okay?
Oh, yes.
I mean, the idea of sort of having everything in its place, including your room as a kid growing up, right?
Yeah, folding garbage, which sounds ridiculous, but it, you know, to me, it made perfect sense. Fold the garbage in the garbage can. So I think I came by the anxiety, honestly.
You're right. This book is really about going to Juilliard in many ways. And I mean, it seems, and perhaps this is not surprising, a kind of sink or swim place, at least when you were there. I don't know if it's any different today, but essentially you were on your own.
Yes. Yeah. No dorms at the time, which I really appreciated, actually, because I felt like you really had to just do everything on your own. And if you couldn't do that, you probably shouldn't be in music anyway,
really?
Because so much of it is self-promotion, self-propulsion, let's say. You no one's telling you get in a practice room and practice. If you're not willing to do that and or looking forward to it, you probably won't be doing that kind of music anyway.
I mean, it sounded like most of the time at Juilliard was then practicing.
Yes.
And then playing for your various teachers, yes?
Playing for teachers, playing for colleagues, playing in orchestra. That's what we did there.
So how many hours a day basically practicing, you think, when you were at Juilliard?
It wouldn't be unusual to practice for 6 hours a day. It wasn't unusual to play much longer than that because we would have percussion ensemble or have a lesson or have orchestra rehearsals. So playing hours and hours a day.
And did you enjoy do you enjoy the practicing?
I loved practicing. Some people do, some don't, but I love to practice. It was like a big puzzle, I thought.
Ah.
How do you figure out how to get better? It's all up to you, really. A lot of it is up to you.
So when you were practicing, you weren't feeling anxious?
Nope.
You were actually enjoying yourself?
I was enjoying it, yeah. I liked the process. The process was thrilling. It was a real process of discovery.
Which is what? Breaking down a piece into its parts and putting it back together and sort of understanding how the music fits together?
Even more elemental than that, just how do I play? What do I need to do to win a job? And how do I get those parts together? How do I play a snare drum roll? Something as simple as that. How do you make a great snare drum roll better?
How about for you, Chris? What's your approach to practicing?
Same thing, really. I think that's something all musicians share in common, is that attaining that goal, obviously we'd like to be working. And professionally speaking, that comes down to, at least in the orchestral field, to winning an audition. It's the process that everyone has to become familiar with and get better at navigating through.
Is it developing a thick skin? Is it, I mean, 30 rejections or 29 rejections for you, Chris? How about, I mean, who's counting, but how do you deal with that and go on? And I know there were times where you just felt like, I can't do this anymore.
I think you have to have the view that rejection is a good thing. And it was the same process writing a book. I sent off many, many queries.
Did
you? And got a lot of rejections. So if you view rejection as a gift, this is saying, I need to make this better. Something needs to be better. And I think we both have that, just the idea that rejection is a tool. It's not that it doesn't get hard. There were times I thought, I don't know if I can do this. But those went away quickly.
Yeah. But I mean, it's a great way to think about rejection. We've all had to deal with
yes.
it in our own kind of way, which is somebody's telling me something important that I need to understand.
Right. I never saw a rejection at an audition as a way to say that they're wrong necessarily. I definitely wanted to feel confident enough to say, well, they missed an opportunity to hire a good musician.
Of course.
But I mostly took away from the rejection, okay, well, what do I need to do better next time?
Yes.
And we close out my conversation with percussionist Patty Nemi and Christopher Devini with Devini's performance of G.H. Green's Van's Brilliant with the Westchester University Percussion Ensemble. Nemi's book is called Sticking It Out, From Juilliard to the Orchestra Pit, A Percussionist's Memoir. And when we get back from the break, we'll hear from New York Times writer Phyllis Corky about the best way to overcome procrastination. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. As the new year approaches, many of us will make promises that this year we will finally follow through on those projects that we've always wanted to complete.
but why didn't it happen last year? Well, according to New York Times reporter Phyllis Corky, it was fear. Corky, who has always wanted to write a book, took a look at herself to figure out the roots of procrastination. And she wrote about it in her new book called The Big Thing, How to Complete Your Creative Project Even If You're a Lazy, Self-Doubting Procrastinator Like Me. Let's take a listen. Well, I'm looking at your subtitle where you call yourself lazy.
Yes.
Circled that because that's name-calling.
Yes.
And I don't think that's particularly productive, but it's in the subtitle there, and you write a lot about laziness. What do you mean by that?
Well, it is a self-critical kind of label, and that's deliberate. It's tongue-in-cheek in a way because I'm actually not lazy. If you talk to my coworkers, they would say that I'm definitely not lazy. So it is something that it's a label you put on yourself that can get in your own way, and that's my very point in putting it in the subtitle.
And how having that self-described label, how has that gotten in your way, or how did that get in your way?
Well, you say I'm such a lazy person, and it's such an overall kind of label that you don't tend to get into the reasons why. And it's not that I'm lazy, it's that I'm afraid. I'm afraid of failure. That's more of what it is than laziness. You get this grandiose idea in your head. Say you want to write a novel, which is something I've wanted to do. Okay. And you think you get this idea in your head that it's going to be this wonderful thing. And then you try to start, and it's just this paltry, pathetic little thing that does not match the grandiose idea that you had. And so it causes you to stop.
Is it the grandiose idea? Is that also part of the problem? I mean, writing
Yes.
novels is really hard. I've never written one, but I've interviewed a lot of novelists.
It is. And what I point out is that this grandiosity relates to narcissism. And it's actually narcissism not to work on a big thing, because that way it can remain perfect in your head because you haven't done it.
Explain what you mean by that. Flesh that out.
Well, okay, narcissism means that you have this overweening sense of your own importance. And so say you want to write a novel, and then it starts building up and up and up in your head. It's going to be this great classic. You know, for me, it'll be the next Jane Eyre or
right.
something. And then you start to write it, and suddenly you realize how hard it is, and it's nowhere near the caliber of what you were expecting. And so to support this idea of yourself as being this paragon of perfection, you stop doing it, because that way you can just rely on your potential, and you can, you know, your future self can do the work someday, and your future self will be perfect at it and write the classic, the modern American classic.
What a fantasy, right?
Yes, it is a fantasy.
So tell us then, I mean, in certain ways, you almost tricked yourself into writing this book,
yes.
right?
Yes, I did. And I one thing I realized that works a lot, and I highly recommend to anyone who wants to do a big project, is to create fake accountability.
Ah, fake accountability. All right.
Yes.
Again, flesh that out for us.
Yes. So that's a way of forcing yourself. It's the way when I wrote that column on deadlines and I told my colleagues, I'm going to get this done. And, you know, I'm going to get it done on Thursday. And there's no way I would not do it because, well, there was a space in the paper and I had said I would do it. Well, I needed to create that same sense of accountability for this project that didn't actually have a firm deadline. So what I did, what I finally came up with, is I put an ad on Craigslist, and I said, I will pay someone $200 to call me every morning at 7 a.m. and check with me and make sure that I'm starting to write my book. Then call me back again at 9 a.m. and make sure that I have done it, and scold me if I haven't done it, and congratulate me if I have.
And you got a dairy farmer to do this, right?
Yes. I got 80 responses. There were
That's
a lot.
Terrific.
I think that what I was, you know, I was offering way too much money for that. I could have gotten by with $50 for that, but because it's not very many. It doesn't take a lot of time to call someone. And I got a lot of responses, but I got this one from a dairy farmer in Washington State saying, you know, if you don't mind someone calling you from across the country, I'll be getting up and milking my cows at 4 a.m. my time, and I would be happy to call you.
And then I'll be round about the time that you're finishing, I'll be waking up my 7 children. And she was going to, she was perfectly happy to call me during that time.
And did it work?
It totally worked. It totally worked. It was, I felt, I was so nervous, and I got up and waited for her to call, and she called me. She said, "How are you doing on your project, Phyllis?" She was so upbeat. She was the perfect person to call me. And so there's no way I was going to let her down. And of course, I could have lied, but I'm from Minnesota, and I'm a really honest person, and I just can't lie. And so she called. And what was really funny is Thursday, I was already, I got up, I was sitting at my desk, and she didn't call. And I was so worried. And then finally she called at like 8:30 my time. And she said, "Oh, I'm so sorry, Phyllis. One of my children had a cold and we fell asleep on the couch together. And I woke up late." So that was kind of
fun. That's life. Well, it sounds like this dairy farmer who called you every day was a lovely woman. Did she ever have to berate you? And would have berating you gotten you to work more on your book?
Well, I couldn't bear the thought of her berating me. I think so, and so I didn't get to that point. I just could not. I couldn't stand the thought of her doing that. And some people, I think, do need the negative incentive. And there's a psychologist named Dan Ariely who talks about that. And he says if you want a negative incentive, you can do something like write a check out to an organization that you abhor, give it to a friend, and say, "If I don't do my writing assignment, send this check for, you know, $100 to this terrible organization that I absolutely detest." And, you know, maybe it'll show up in the public records even, who knows. Or, you know, even have them, you know, call you out on Facebook. Phyllis didn't write her 1,000 words today. Shame on her. Things like that.
It'd be interesting to know what works. I'm not sure.
You know, different people are different. Yeah, right. And you know, it sounds kind of corny. It sounds kind of ridiculous. But the fact is, it works. People don't like to be publicly shamed.
Well, it's interesting that you made your dairy farmer almost act like your colleagues in that you don't want to disappoint your colleagues at the New York Times, and you did not want to disappoint this dairy farmer who you were paying her, but nonetheless investing some of her time and energy to make sure that you got this book done.
Yeah, and I don't know if everyone's like that, but I think a lot of people are that way. And you can do that, too. It's not like you have to pay someone. A lot of people have accountability buddies. I actually did that with another woman who had applied for the job to call me. And she was writing a memoir called Scandalous about her scandalous past. And after the dairy farmer, we actually just called each other and texted each other and said, "Hey, are you work? Did you get up yet? You know, come on, you can do it. You got to get in that chair and start writing." And that worked too. I think the dairy farmer was better though.
And what a great story to have.
Yeah, I had money in the game.
What did you learn from psychologists? You mentioned one earlier, but you talked to a number of psychologists and looked at some of the writings of some of the other psychologists who have talked about some of these issues. And what did you learn from what they say about what prevents us from doing these big creative projects?
Well, I think I learned that there is just a lot of tendency to procrastinate, again, because of this narcissistic issue that we have. And also there's this, a lot of people, there was one psychologist who talked about there's chronological age. We sometimes think we have to do things when we're young, but life actually gets in the way. And there's just this horrible psychic overhang that starts to develop over time. But psychologists have found that you can keep this flame alive for decades, and then say when your children have grown up, or after you get a divorce, or something like that, it can come into full force again, and you can do it. And I'm an example of that.
So the idea of sort of holding on to this idea or this creative dream, not saying, in your case, Phyllis, after 40 years, I'm never going to write a book, that you can still accomplish something like that.
Yes, but there are exceptions to that. Sometimes I have a whole chapter on giving up, too, where you have to really analyze what is the true reason you want to do this. Now, is it mainly, is it more than 50% for acclaim from others? This taps into the narcissism again. Is you want admiration and acclaim. You want to be famous. What I point out in this book is that you have to mainly want to do this for the intrinsic rewards and not for the extrinsic awards. I talked to somebody who did some research on that, and it has to be personally meaningful in the main. You can't hope that it's going to make you rich and famous. If that's the main reason you're doing it, you probably should give up on it.
I mean, you have to want to do this for yourself. I mean, it sounds like that's what you're saying. Bottom line, it has to be for yourself.
Right. Right. And that's why this book really fell into that category for me, regardless of how it does in sales or anything like that. It feels really good and fulfilling that I did it.
As you're talking, I'm thinking about the conversations that we're constantly having with ourselves about whether we're good enough or we're not good enough, or just the sort of ongoing monologue that we have going on in our head. And it's funny when you analyze it, there is a lot of that sort of beating up of ourselves that we do that we might never do to a friend or a colleague or a family member, but we seem so justified in doing to ourselves.
Yes, I do that all the time. I just am constantly beating on myself for never being good enough. And they're really, what's the point? And sometimes that's when you really have to sit down. Maybe you even do need to go to a therapist, because there's the psychic overhang can really take a toll. And if you are somehow thinking to yourself that I am not a valuable person because I haven't written a novel, you know, you need to have some therapy maybe to realize, well, maybe that's not what I'm supposed to be doing. And really just my day-to-day life is my big thing. Just having a garden and playing with my cat or my dog and being a good parent, maybe that's my big thing in life.
And being okay about it, right? I mean, those are big things, right?
Being a good person. I mean, I don't have children myself, but, you know, raising children, that is a really big thing. And that is something that leaves a legacy. And that in itself is important. And why should you feel you have to do something else, like write a play or start a business? Or it might not be realistic, and you're doing it for the wrong reasons.
You also consulted a nutritionist. You went to a breathing expert. Why was that part of your process of understanding why you weren't able to complete this project?
Well, because when I got the book contract immediately, so then my editor wisely had me do monthly deadlines, and I had to get started. I was accountable to somebody, really. And I went into this tailspin of anxiety. And I went to my doctor and I said, can you please give me some Klonopin? Because I'd had some Klonopin briefly 10 years ago and it was so nice. And she refused. She said it was addictive. And I thought, what am I going to do? I was having these stomach pains. I was having the shortness of breath. I was having back pain because how was I going to write this book? There was no way I was going to be able to do it. It was going to be horrible. And so I thought, I have got to turn to my own body and not have it turn against me. So I went to a breathing specialist, and she made me realize that I've been breathing wrong. I've been breathing from my shoulders, and I've been breathing vertically. And that's the worst possible way to breathe. What you want to do is breathe from your diaphragm, which is much lower down, and breathe horizontally. What this does is bring more blood to your brain, and it calms down your stomach.
And did that help you?
Has helped me to this day.
Really?
I cannot tell you how I recommend everybody take a breathing lesson. And there's a lot of things I haven't mentioned. I mean, it's more involved than that. You really need to take a lesson and have somebody analyze the specific way that you breathe. But you would be surprised. And it's better than a prescription for Klonopin, is to breathe from the lower part of your body and breathe horizontally. And there's things in your inhale and your exhale. It's how children breathe, but then society just has its way with us and makes us breathe in the totally wrong way that is totally counterproductive.
So that helped with what, things like fatigue or energy, low energy?
And anxiety.
Yeah.
Yes, that was the main thing, is that, you know, my stomach started just, you know, it was hurting so much and the back pain and everything. And I also took posture lessons, which doesn't immediately make sense maybe, but it made me in touch with my own body. And she said one thing, and this is one thing I'll share with you. She said, imagine the top of your head. And it's funny, because usually when you try to have good posture, you get all you know, you get all ramrod straight and tense. But this just sort of gently has you move your head towards the sky. And it grounds you, too. You move your feet, you ground your feet, and you have arrows coming out of the sides of your shoulders. And basically, you're inhabiting your own space. And the Alexander technique, which I learned, has a concept called end gaining, where you leap ahead of yourself. And so you're there before you're there. And so, but to work on a big thing, you have to be right in the moment and where you are. And your physical position is very much a part of that.
Was that a revelation to you, all of
it
this?
It really was. And if you have back pain, before you have surgery, I would recommend posture lessons, because they very gently bring you in back in touch with your own body and have you take up your own space, which we really need to do in life. We forget about the mind-body connection when we're working on intellectual big thing.
You know, it's interesting. We've been talking. You're a writer, obviously, and we've been talking a lot about what it takes to write. And I've interviewed so many writers, and one writer whose name I forget, but he's pretty well known, said for him, it's excruciating to write. He says, for me, the joy, even the liberating feeling, is having written.
Yes.
And I just latched on to that. I think we can apply that to a lot of other parts of our lives that have nothing to do with writing a book. But that sometimes it's really hard.
It is. It is really hard. And you know what I just did? Have you heard of National Novel Writing Month?
Oh, well, only because you include that at the end of your book, right?
Yes. You write a novel in 1 month, and it's an international program that this man named Chris Beatty started in the 1990s. And it's this hundreds of thousands of people have done it, and you write a novel in 1 month. It's 50,000 words, and basically it's 1,700 words a day. And the idea is that you do it no matter what, and you have these groups. You go to a cafe, and you write with other people. And I actually just did it.
Oh, you did?
And yes, just this last November. I cannot believe I did it. And it was excruciating, but somehow the idea that all these other people were doing it, and the idea that, okay, he says, you don't care how good it is, you know it's going to be bad. The idea is just to do it. And that is enormously liberating. And it makes it less excruciating when you just know it's going to be bad.
That was my conversation recorded earlier this year with New York Times reporter Phyllis Korke about her book, The Big Thing. Up next, the architect of the atomic age, the life of Enrico Fermi. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Nuclear weapons have been an underlying force shaping international relations and the prospects of war for decades. But many of those who advanced the science behind nuclear energy were well-meaning and wanted to further understand the physical world. One such physicist, Enrico Fermi, created breakthroughs that led to the Manhattan Project and created what is known now as the atomic age. We learned about the work and life of Enrico Fermi when we were joined by Gino Segre and Bettina Herlin, co-authors of the book The Pope of Physics. Let's take a listen. Did you ever meet Enrico Fermi?
My parents say I only met him once, I think, and I was 2 years old, so I don't remember meeting him. My father and he, that is, our parents, my parents, and the Fermis had just immigrated to the United States. And so, and my father was teaching then at Columbia, as was Fermi. So there we were, Italian immigrants, and I was the baby in the family.
Let me turn to you, Bettina. You were then a teenager living in Los Alamos. Fermi would come and what, hike? You would see him hiking?
Well, Fermi was a major hiker, had actually done some technical climbing too. And one of the things he loved about Los Alamos was that it's in the mountains of New Mexico. People think of New Mexico as desert. But in northern New Mexico, there are, in fact, beautiful mountains and some challenging ones. So he, although, of course, he was in Los Alamos during the war years, continued to come to Los Alamos after those years. So the last summer that he was in Los Alamos was 1953.
Yeah.
And then the next summer he went to Italy and then died shortly after that. But 1953 was the last summer, and it was a very European tradition. Los Alamos was full of European scientists, and they would have their Sunday hikes or walks. And Fermi was part of that. And my father, who was an accomplished mountaineer. He had held the world record in mountain climbing in the Alps and in the Andes and in the Himalayas in 1930, was, of course, a leader of those hikes. And Fermi was someone who was always wanting to be in front, but I don't think he challenged my father.
So he was a good ambitious hiker?
He was an ambitious hiker, and my father made a comment once to me. My father never learned how to pronounce the W's and the V's in English. So he would say, I never had to worry about Fermi. But I think Fermi respected the fact that my father was a better mountaineer, and my father certainly respected the fact that Fermi was a better physicist.
Interesting. To what do we owe Enrico Fermi? What did he bring us in terms of our understanding of the world that we live in, and also how that ushered in the atomic age?
Well, when we talk about Fermi, the first thing we think of course, is the atom bomb. And that's there in the title, The Birth of the Atomic Age. And it is indeed true. If there was one person that is responsible for the physics behind the bomb, it is Enrico Fermi. That said, it also brought in the benefits of the life-saving nuclear medicine, the nuclear reactors. But that's part of him. His legacy really as a physicist is astounding. He is the last person to really have known all of physics. He contributed to every part of physics, atoms, relativity, molecules, nuclei. He was also the only person in the 20th century to have reached the very peaks as both a theorist and an experimentalist. And he was perhaps the most influential educator in physics, a team builder, a charismatic physicist.
Hmm.
I could go on all day talking about his contributions, but I don't think it's appropriate.
Well, I hear what you're saying. Can we put him on the same level as Galileo, for instance? I mean, it's a little bit apples and oranges, but nonetheless.
He certainly is the greatest Italian scientist since Galileo, and a source of enormous pride in Italy. And in fact, when he embarked on his career, there was almost no physics, no 20th century physics in Italy. And he single-handedly with his team brought it into the 20th century. I think Einstein is in a class by himself. But when you talk about Niels Bohr, Heisenberg, Pauli, Feynman, and these type of people, Fermi certainly belongs there.
Well, let's go to December 2nd, 1942. We're making a leap here.
What happened then?
What happened then on a squash court, of all things? There's a photograph of this squash court in the book here. And Fermi and his, fellow scientists there are working on what, Gino?
Fission had been discovered 2 years earlier, and fission, i.e. the splitting up of the very core of the atom, the nucleus, had the potential for the release of enormous amount of energy. The question was, could it be done in a chain reaction? Because if a chain reaction could be obtained, then you could build a bomb. So the key was seeing if you could have this chain reaction. And that required assembling some 45,000 20-pound bricks of carbon with uranium embedded in it, with control rods and all that kind of stuff, and then gradually pulling the control rods and seeing if you could have a chain reaction. It had to stop.
My palms
after.
Are sweating as you're describing this.
The chain reaction had to be stopped after a few minutes. Otherwise, it would continue, blow up the court and probably the
university
and maybe the city of Chicago. So there was one man in charge of this, and that man was Tina. What was his name?
I forget. Enrico Fermi.
Who was cool as a cucumber, right?
Cool as a cucumber. And here this was an experiment taking place. About 50 people were in that because they were in the stands of this squash court. And they were watched. Some of them were watching. And one of the things about that scene that stands out to me is that there was one woman. There was only one woman in that whole crowd. And she was the one who would be basically talking, shouting out the neutron count. So you had this female voice. I think this has the makings of an opera. Doing the neutron count and all of it very steady. And these 50 people who on some level, different levels, probably knew that the whole thing could blow up and they would be blown to smithereens, had great faith in Fermi. He really did create around him that people said, this is the Pope of physics. He is infallible. He will not make a mistake. We are in good hands.
Yeah,
And the code said the Italian navigator has just landed in the new world. That was the code to say this was a success.
Yeah, that was the code that was relayed by telephone from Chicago to Washington. But just to give you an idea of the cool there, just before noon, at one point, there was a safety rod. If things went wrong, it would lower with a boom. It had been set at too low a level, so it descended with a large noise. Everybody jumped in the air. Fermi looked around and said, it's okay. Let's go have lunch.
And then they
went out to lunch and came back and he said, okay, time to start again.
Well, you teach at the University of Pennsylvania, so I'm trying to imagine if you had told your president, we're going to do this in the squash court. How do you feel about that?
I think the president, I haven't consulted Amy Gutman, but I suspect she would say no. And in fact, when they did this experiment, originally, they had decided to do it in a forest about 20 miles away from Chicago, but they ran into some labor problems, and Fermi said, it's okay. We can just do it in a squash court. And the head of the Manhattan Project said, don't I have to tell the president of the university? And then he decided, uh-oh, I better not, because if I tell him, he's going to say no. And Fermi says, don't worry, I'll take care of it.
Do you think they were naive, that they didn't know what they were dealing with, or just supremely confident, believing that Fermi had things under control, Bettina? Do we know the answer to that?
Oh, I think they did know what they were dealing with. Again, to certain different people, there was somebody from Westinghouse. He saw this as a remarkable opportunity for new energy. They had different cuts at it. But there, as I said before, I think that there was tremendous faith in Fermi. People knew that it was dangerous. That it happened in a squash court is one thing. That it happened underneath a football field stadium. I was telling a friend of mine this, and it's a remarkable story, and her response to it was, I never knew that Chicago had football.
So, oh, my goodness.
Yes. So it was a defunct football field.
Let me quote something from his longtime friend, Franco Rossetti. You include this in this book. He said this in April of 46. He says, it seems almost impossible that people I once regarded as endowed with a sense of human dignity have let themselves to be the instrument of such monstrous degradation. And yet this is so, and they don't even seem to be aware of it. In my opinion, these scientists, among the many friends of mine, including Fermi, might face severe judgment by history. That tells us a lot about Rossetti.
Yeah, I think Rossetti believed in that science should be pure. And in fact, he had left Italy and was in Canada at that point. He was invited to join the British mission, and he refused to do so. He said, science must just be pure, not building weapons or anything like that. his feelings were so strong that after the war, he more or less abandoned physics and switched to studying trilobites, whatever those are, fossils and so on. He became a great fossil hunter and a naturalist.
Did you want to add something, Bettina?
Yeah, I think the first part of that question was also about Fermi being rational as at Trinity, when the Trinity was when the first bomb was piloted in the New Mexico desert. And, Gino, do you want to describe his response to that?
Very briefly, I'll say that, you know, we have the record of many people, Oppenheimer famously saying, "Now I am, you know, the destroyer of people," quoting the Bhagavad Gita. Kenneth Bainbridge saying, "Now we're all sons of bitches," etc. Fermi, what he did was tearing up little pieces of paper, seeing how the shock wave from the bomb blew them, measuring off the distance, and then turning to people and saying, "The explosion is 10,000 tons of TNT equivalent." Mm-hmm. That is, he was rational. He treated it as another physics experiment. He was keeping his emotions in control. On the other hand, I will say that Fermi and Szilard were close friends. They worked together at the beginning of the war. Szilard was also an organizer. He had known Einstein from Berlin days. And so it was natural for him to approach Einstein and trying to get Einstein to write a letter. But I would say that Szilard and Fermi were collaborators in getting the United States going, Szilard pushing harder than Fermi, certainly. But they did regard Heisenberg and the Germans as their adversary, not each other.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is that Szilard was a fighter. He was a fighter politically. And he at one point made a comment about Fermi, that Fermi was not a fighter politically. This was not where he wanted to put his energy. He didn't feel he was an expert at it. But on the other hand, he was the first person chosen to warn the United States government that Germany may be poised to make an atomic bomb. So a couple of months after Fermi had come here, come to the United States, some physicists, including Szilard, said, somebody has to warn Washington, and how about you, Fermi? You just got the Nobel Prize, and that gives you some kind of credibility. So would you go down and warn Washington about this threat, what we see as a threat, potential threat in terms of Germany developing the bomb? So Fermi did that in March of 39. He goes down and he meets with a U.S. admiral in the Navy. The desk officer who greets him there goes to tell the admiral that Enrico Fermi has come in, but he doesn't put it that way. He says, "There's a WAP outside." The WAP being a derogatory term at that time for the Italians. So Fermi was not only an enemy alien at one point, but he was denigrated as a WAP, as an immigrant,
as the other. How should we understand the Fermi principle? What is the Fermi principle?
There are sometimes called in physics the Fermi question, which means Fermi was famous for being able to estimate anything. As he said, in a day, I can estimate to within a factor of two any physical phenomena. If you want me to do better than that, it might take me longer. Wow. So, and he would ask questions to people. Sometimes they're very simple, like, how many piano tuners are there in Chicago? How many sheep are there in Nebraska? How high are the flames?
And he knew the answer to this? Or he could figure it out?
He said, "Let's figure it out."
Well, these were students primarily, and they loved this kind of questions. But it was, how do you estimate things? And trying to get people to think in a broad way about what they're doing.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to talk about all of this in these times when we do have worries about nuclear proliferation, questions about immigration. I'm not giving you enough time, Bettina, just to weigh in on that, about 30 seconds. But what are your thoughts?
Well, I think one of the things about this book, about the Pope of Physics, is that it is so timely because it does talk about issues that we continue to struggle with the whole nuclear threat, and particularly now with smaller nations being close to getting nuclear bombs, immigration policies, about what is the role of science in government and the role of secrecy.
That was my conversation with Gino Segre and Bettina Herland about their book, The Pope of Physics, Enrico Fermi and the Birth of the Atomic Age. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Liz Fiedler, Trinae Nuri, and John Ahrens, who edits the show. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us, and have a great new year.